Should your spouse be your best friend? That's the topic of my share and hour tonight, just starting with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935. According to this article by Bruce Feiler in the New York Times, there is a reason why your spouse should not be your best friend, and we'll explore that. They can be your most intimate friend, but is it necessarily a good thing, this article asks, if marriage becomes just benefits with friendship? In other words, if you're so enmeshed in the day-to-day logistics that you've given up on passion and sexual attraction and erotic play. Professor John Helliwell, who's the editor of the World Happiness Report, did some research on this and found that the only friends that boost our life satisfaction are real friends, not online friends, but real life friends. Probably less so for married people because they have each other. And he said a few more men than women said that their spouses were their best friends. But he said that's because men tend to have fewer friends in general. But when asked if it was necessary to consider your spouse as your best friend for a good marriage, he said absolutely not. He said it's just a bonus. But others say not so much. A psychiatrist and neuroscientist at Columbia University, Amir Levine, whose topic is also social relations, said that we all have a hierarchy of attachment, the ranking of people we call if something bad happened. When we're young, parents or other members of your family are usually at the top of the ranking. But as we get older, he suggested that nature came up with a trick called attraction. Because as we get older, to let somebody in who's basically a stranger is really difficult, unless there's sexual attraction, which brings down all the barriers. And that allows you to get close to someone new in a physical way that you don't have with your family. Of course, sexual attraction, physical attraction, as we know, does wane over time. And well, we might regret this. Dr. Levine said, no, it's smart. If you're going to be crazy about the other person all the time, how are you going to raise kids? How are you going to be able to work? So the waning of sexual attraction, he suggests, should be considered an achievement because now you've forged that connection. You're attached to another person with a feeling of security and it allows you to go out in the world and be an individual again. He says it's the idea of friends versus lovers that can get us into trouble. We still need what he calls maintenance sex because it re-establishes the physical closeness and renews that sexual attraction. And he said friendship is just too small a word for what's actually going on, which is you have someone there for you in a profound way that gives you the courage to explore, imagine, and create. You have a consistent partner who's readily available and responsive and reliable and predictable in a world that is where you're calling your spouse your best friend.
If you're ever in a jam, here I am.
If you're ever in a mess, S-O-S.
If you ever feel so happy you land in jail, I'm your bail.
It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect friendship. When other friendships have been forgot, ours will still be hot.
A la da 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 da, dig dig dig.
If you're ever down a well, ring my bell.
And if you're ever up a tree, just phone to me.
Yes, sirree. If you ever lose your teeth and you're out to dine, borrow mine. It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect friendship. When other friendships have been forget, ours will still be great. A loddle, doddle, doddle, chuck, chuck, chuck.
If they ever black your eyes, put me wise.
If they ever cook your goose, turn me loose.
And if they ever put a bullet through your beret, complain. It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect blandship. When other friendships have been forget, ours will still be it.
If you ever lose your mind, I'll be kind.
And if you ever lose your shirt, I'll be hurt.
If you're ever in a mill and get sawed in half, I won't laugh. It's friendship, friendship, just a perfect blandship. When other friendships are up the creek, ours will still be slick. A lot of lot of lot of woof woof woof. Hep hep hep, a chuck chuck chuck, a dig dig dig. Good evening, friend.
Friendship, it's a magical thing. But should your spouse be your best friend is another matter. On my Sharon Hour tonight, that's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, I'm exploring that question currently with reference to a New York Times article of that title. The article quotes a couple of doctors who've been married for more than 30 years. One of them suggests that amongst the criteria for best friend is someone who makes you feel unconditionally accepted. But with your best friend, you might not care if they're messy in the kitchen or leave the bathroom in shambles and don't pay their income taxes. With a spouse, you do. The other doctor said she wished popular magazines wouldn't keep going on about you shouldn't get married in order to change someone. She said, I think that's what marriage is about. It's where some of the juices come from. And it's also how you get the best out of the person you marry. If you're pushing each other and challenging each other and encouraging each other to change. The doctors, when asked if they were best friends, laughed. We're good friends, said one. Really good friends, said the other, the female in the partnership. She said, he's lots of things my best friend isn't, but my best friend is lots of things that he's not. So you can say your spouse is your best friend, but maybe that's just saying you like them as well as love them, and that you have a shared history, shared lives, and shared ambitions and dreams. But push comes to shove. If your spouse is your best friend, who do you go to complain about your spouse? The thing is, attraction is always in the mix, isn't it, when you choose your friends? It is for me, anyway. I'm a straight woman, and even my female friends, I like to be attractive physically, and there's a sense of pride in them when they are. Is that terribly shallow? I just feel that we're all drawn to certain people more than others. And physical attraction doesn't have to be a component, and it can develop. But it's always sort of there when you decide you've fallen in love with someone. Platonic love or sexual physical attraction. And falling in love can happen so fast you can't really say that your lover is your instant best friend. So I guess I'm saying that the physical attraction component is always present in some way at the beginning of a relationship. And then when that relationship gets more profound and you've given them your heart and soul, there might come a point where you have to stand back and justify that. But to backtrack here, should your spouse be your best friend? My topic on tonight's KX935 Sharon Hour only, of course, applies to people that have a spouse. What about single people who are searching for a spouse, moreover, for that spouse's best friend? Maybe like young Hayley Quinn, who's going to tell you her story as she told it at TED, when the one she hoped would be both her spouse and her best friend didn't turn out to be either. She found the best friend any of us could. Here's her story.
Once upon a time, not so long ago, I met a guy. And he was perfect. He was tall, dark, handsome, kind of a rock star, and a little bit emotionally unavailable. Very soon, we were spending all of our time together. We threw these really cool parties for all of our cool friends. We went backstage at every festival, and when my hands were cold, he would take them under his arms to warm them up. He was my best friend, and I thought we would be together forever. And so strong was that belief that when the warning signs came, I just ignored them. Until the day that I couldn't ignore them anymore. I'd become quite unwell. I wasn't so pretty anymore, and I definitely couldn't go out to any of the parties. In fact, I was, for the first time in my life, actually vulnerable because I was miscarrying our baby. And at that point, when I was at my weakest, he left. Coming downstairs, and I would have followed him out of the door to the ends of the earth, but I couldn't get out of my bed. When I did get up, I found that our house had been stripped bare. The paintings were gone from the walls, and the rooms that we used to dance in together were empty. I walked around those rooms like an animal howling. Picking myself up off the literal floor that day, I had to recognize that after all of this excitement and this joy and this fantasy, at the end of all that love, I had nothing. And you know what? That wasn't even the first time something like that had happened to me. I was a magnet for chaos. I liked chaos because when I was in chaos, I didn't have to confront anything about who I was. Truthfully, I hadn't known who I was for years. Because on the floor that day, I did have someone. I had myself. But for a long time, that had come to feel like it meant nothing. So I know it seems a bit self-indulgent to talk about effectively a breakup story, but it was one of a chain of many incidences that made me think, maybe there's other people like me, maybe there's other people that aren't approaching love in the right way. Because I think we've all had experiences, right, that like they look like love, they feel like love, but when you open them up, there's nothing loving about them. But we continue to chase love because I think love is sold to us as almost the ultimate solution to ourselves. The thing that makes our past okay, that gives us a direction for the future, and imbues our everyday reality with meaning. I think love can be beautiful. I think it can be exciting. I think sometimes it can also be an act of escapism. And I've had a long time to think about this. I am the artist formerly known as the UK's leading dating expert. And before that, I was a ghostwriter in the pickup industry, and I vlog about the reality of love on my YouTube. But you know what? Like, after everything that happened, I thought, I would quite like to know who I am again, because I think I'm not alone here. If you're experiencing Groundhog Day when it comes to your dating life, you think that it's because you're meeting loads of players, or nice guys finish last, or you just haven't met the one yet, or that dating is a numbers game. The problem, and I know this doesn't make for comfy listening, the problem it's with you, it's with me, it's with our ridiculous ideas around romance, it's with our needs that we haven't realized yet, it's with our past that we don't want to talk about, it's with our desires, it's with our inability to get through one day without picking up our smartphones. And then you just take one look at Instagram, everybody else has it sorted out. And we sort of live in a culture that surrounds us, telling us that we should have fallen in love or be falling in love or at least have had great sex, right? Don't get me wrong. I think that the desire for attachment, for intimacy, for security, for love, those goals are natural, they're human, and they're good. But I think sometimes the way we go about them is a bit weird, whether that's crazy, ridiculous, on-off destructive relationships or needing to go out on a date every single night of the week with a different person. It feels really like loneliness is the driver or escapism is the driver. I think sometimes the melodrama of love takes us further away rather than closer to who we actually are. I'm concerned that in our quest for love, sometimes it can be the ultimate distraction to fixing ourselves and doing the real work that will actually make us happy. So I find that my dating advice is gradually shrinking down to be essentially, go meditate, get some therapy, read a book. You know, like, let's face it, who actually enters into the arena of love looking to maybe become a better person, to be kinder, to have more integrity, to get more grounded? No one does that. It's because our eyes are off ourselves. We're looking for that next adventure, that greener grass, that new person, so we don't have to deal with any of that stuff. And I understand how easily it happens, right? You just kind of meet someone sexy. Maybe it was at a party, on the train, or the tube, as we would say in London. Or maybe you just both joined Tinder that day. How magical. And before too long, you realize that you have some stuff in common. Like, wow, you both like almond butter. I think the thing is, the main sell when you kind of fall for someone is it's like, I'm not alone anymore. Hooray. Nailed it. Because you get to, guess what you do? You get to go home every night and you get to put your head on the pillow and you don't have to think about your needs, your wants, your past, and actually kind of all the stuff that's really probably stopping you from becoming happy because you're not fixing it. Instead, you get to be entrapped by somebody else. You're intrigued by them. Your mind has someone new to spiral into and focus on. But I think sometimes when you're focusing on that perfect romance, you're not actually doing the real work to fix the stuff that's stopping you from becoming happy.
That realization from Hayley Quinn is also endorsed by another TED speaker, Alexandra Redke. Here's her perspective on this. The Sharon Al and me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. We're talking tonight about, should your spouse be your best friend? Well, I'd suggest that they should certainly fit with the most basic criteria you have for friendship, right?
Two of my very good friends called me within a week of each other and told me that their marriage of over 10 years had failed. Now, even though everyone else around them knew that they weren't really making a good decision at the time, my best friend, the guy that she picked, was kind of controlling. He was dismissive towards women, and he really wanted a woman that would stay home, cook, clean, and have their child. And my friend was not at all interested in that. She was singing jazz in New York City. She was very happy to have that life. But that's not what he was interested in. But somewhere along the way, she fell in love with him. And so she sacrificed for the family. She sacrificed for what she thought was the right decision. And 10 years down the road, she realized she didn't recognize herself, and then she decided to leave. A woman the other day was complaining at 40, saying that there was no good men left. And she said that the only men that are out there are the Peter Pan guys. The men who, as she described, don't want to grow up, they don't want to have kids, they don't want to get married, they don't want to settle down. And she spent all her time and energy trying to un-Peter Pan them. And she asked me, what do I think? Why does this come about, and why can't she find anybody, and why can't she fix this situation? And so I say to her, how honest do you want me to be? And she said, very honest. I'm really serious. I want to fix this problem. How do I do this? And I said, I think you're investing all your energy in people that are really happy. They're totally fine. Why should they get married, have kids, and settle down? They don't want to. You do. So the issue is your focus. The issue is your perspective. How are we selecting partners? And why are we ignoring who they are or the red flags that are right in front of our face? I have women in their 30s and 40s and 50s complaining all the time that they can't find the man of their dreams or woman of their dreams. I have men complaining that they feel that they're being overlooked because they're the good guy, they're the nice guy, they're the friend. And what they find is that people are dating the unavailable person, the player, the pathological liar, the person who's already married. So we make all these decisions in our relationships, and we end up 2-3 years down the road, 10 years down the road, in despair. We struggle to try to find the relationship that we want, whether that leads to marriage or just a long-term commitment. Why do we repeat the cycle over and over and over again? The woman that I talked about earlier that asked my advice about why this happens says, oh no, I don't date the Peter Pan guys. I just see them out there. Well, except the last two relationships, I did date the Peter Pan guy. Oh, okay, so why do you choose them? She couldn't really explain it. So she became really defensive in this conversation and was denying the truth that everyone else around her could see, the people that loved her the most. She sat in a circle of all of her friends. We were just hanging out in the backyard, having a barbecue. And she refused to listen to every single one of them who all said the same thing. We have to open up our heart to a self-assessment. What is going on with us? What are we doing to contribute to these relationships? What are we afraid of? Do we think we're not worth it? Do we think we have to settle for this person? You have to get healthier. And on the path to being healthier, we have to get to know ourselves. I can't tell you how many people say, they go out on a date, and they go, oh, I hope that they like me. And I say, what? I hope you like them. Who cares if they like you? You need to assess this person to figure out if they're a good fit for you. If our entire focus in dating is I hope that they like me, well, no wonder we make bad decisions. And then you have the person who always says, well, let me just put it out there. I'm just going to tell you everything that I'm looking for. I want this kind of person who does this and who's interested in this. Well, the unscrupulous person who just kind of wants to land you in bed is going to tell you all of that stuff that you just told them. So instead of putting everything out there, letting them become who you want temporarily to get what they want, you need to take a step back and figure out what are the most important things for you. Think of three questions. If you really want to get married and have kids and you're 35, that should be one of the first questions you ask. Are you interested in getting married? I'm not saying to me, I'm not saying tomorrow, but is this in your plan? Because there's many people out there that say, no way, I'm good. If I never get married, I'll be happy. So we have to be more bold. We have to know what we want and be stubborn only about the really important stuff.
Not bad advice from Alexandra Ritke in her TED Talk, brought to you now on this The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935.
I had a friend who said she didn't want to date anybody who ever in their entire life did drugs, including pot. And I said, most people have done drugs at least once in their life. So, I mean, is that really important? Like, I could see if they're pothead smoking every week and they're not going to work and, you know, all that stuff. I get it. But we have to really be wise about what we're looking for. How about let's be stubborn about honesty? Is the person honest? That's what we want to be stubborn about. Number one rule, and a lot of people think this is crazy, but I stand by it 100%. Your friends and family must meet your prospect. If you feel uncomfortable and pressured and, oh my gosh, they're going to think I'm crazy, maybe that's a problem. You can stage a fake setup, like, oh, we just happened to go to this restaurant, and oh, look, there's my best friend. Oh, why don't you join us for dinner? Because they will tell you if that person is good for you or not. But the problem is we have to listen to them. And it has to happen early, within 3 to 5 dates. Why? Because that's when we fall in love, within the first 3 or 5 dates. That's when we're already hooked. We might not say it, we might not admit it, but we know it's true. That's when we get hooked, in those early dates. So our friends and family express their concern and we attack them, we're defensive. You'll never be happy if I'm happy. I finally found someone I love and you can't accept it. Well, you just don't know him. He's different when we're alone. Don't lie to yourself and tell yourself that, well, they're just jealous or they never had a good relationship. Listen to them. They love you. They really do only want what's best for you. Then there's a culmination of red flags. And we tell ourselves, well, all relationships take work. Which is true, but we tell ourselves this in a misguided way. So our friends and family express their concern and we attack them, we're defensive. And then we begin to isolate from them. They try to intervene and they say, look, I'm really concerned about this person that you're dating. And I want you to think about that. I want you to try and pick someone else or just end it. And we may even admit to ourselves, yeah, I probably should end it. I know this person isn't good for me. But we don't. And so then what happens is because family or friends or colleagues, coworkers conflict with us and they say, look, there's a problem here. We feel embarrassed. We feel shame. And so what do? We separate from them. So we don't go to the friend's house anymore because they're always complaining. And then the family gets angry. And then they separate from you. They stop trying. And eventually we realize that we were wrong and they were right. And we hate it. It drives us nuts. And then we despair. And then we say, are we ever going to find anybody? And we could have saved so much time and energy and despair if we would just listen to the people that are around us and not be so defensive. So we have to just get a first impression of somebody right from the beginning. And if they say run, run. And don't pay attention to the one person that says to you, oh, whatever makes you happy. I trust you'll make a good decision. No. Don't listen to that person. If 3 out of 5 of your friends or 2 out of 3 say, oh, I don't know, I'm not feeling it, I'm not thinking they're right for you, run. Even if you think, oh, but they have so much potential and we have so much in common. No, just run. You have to trust your community because they're wiser. They are wiser than us when we're in the midst of this. Get ongoing advice pick your mean friend, your friend that's so honest. You're just like, oh, I don't want to ask her because I know she's going to say something bad. Okay, that's the one that you want to go to. Talk to a professional, a consultant, therapist, anyone. Just talk to someone else to get feedback. Pay attention to red flags every day and be brave enough to walk away early. Real love is possible. It is. The relationship that you're in now can be better too. Don't get discouraged. Don't get upset. Believe in your ability to analyze. Trust yourself. Trust your gut. You can do it. Don't be afraid to ask those questions. Don't be intimidated. If you're intimidated to ask that really important question now, what do you think is going to happen in 5 years when you never asked it? Action conquers fear. The more we do it, the more comfortable we get with it.
That's Alexander Redke with some good dating advice via her TED Talk. And I'm bringing it to you as part of my topic on tonight's KX935 Sharon Hour. That's with me, Sharon James. And the topic is, should your spouse be your best friend? If that's what you want, there are certain precautions you should take before he or she becomes your spouse.
Some people have this idea that we're drawn to danger. Why do we date the person who we know is historically unfaithful and a liar? They tell us about their last partner and they cheated on them, but somehow we still think that, oh, they're going to be different with us.
But people tell you who they are. People show you who they are. Don't you game right from the start. People tell you who they are. Get it, then. We just don't listen, don't they, though. Just don't listen, don't they. Just don't listen, don't they, though. Ba-da-boom-ba-bum. We said we'd grow our tree together. High-tailed that soil with all I had. I poured my goodness towards the center. Then your roots drank it up. Boom-ba-da-boom-ba-dum. They just drew it all in the da-da-da-da-dum. Without pouring love back. People tell you who they are. People show you who they are. People tell you who they are. We just don't listen. Just don't listen. Just don't listen, don't they, though, people. I've got to find another garden where my poor roots might have a chance. With one who loves to till that soil with a touch of romance. Gardening with no pants. Don't bid it thing, but up. Don't bid it thing, why not? Hit to get it on to why not?
So far on this Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935, on should your spouse be your best friend, we have learnt that maybe he or she shouldn't be. Maybe your romantic partner, whether your spouse or not, shouldn't be your best friend because you should be your best friend. You maybe have to find yourself before you can find anyone else. It's an old theme, but now I'm going to present a little twist on even that. Maybe you have to first lose yourself before finding love. That's Mia Hansen's TED story.
My parents met against all the odds. My father was born in Sweden and my mother in the Philippines, and they lived 6,000 miles apart. They were born during the Second World War. And the way they met was that their schools arranged an English exchange for them to learn English through letters and letter writing. And they loved sharing their curiosity about the world and about different cultures. And they exchanged photos that they'd made themselves. And after 3 or 4 years, they started falling in love without even having met. After about 5 years of letter writing, as soon as my mother finally made it to Denmark, Dad hot-footed it over and immediately proposed the same day. And my parents have now been happily married for almost 50 years. So I thought love is this easy ideal of a man and a woman meeting and having 3 healthy children, and everything works out wonderfully because they made it look so easy. So I spent the next 20 years of my life following this ideal and trying to match it with what I'd seen when I grew up. When I was 17, I put out a pen pal advert because I thought, I'm going to meet somebody in exactly the same way as my parents, because that's obviously the way it works. Unfortunately, all I got in return for the advert was pictures of penises and an invite to Florida from a middle-aged man that I'd never been in touch with in my life. Eventually, I did meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger who was a very kind man, but unfortunately, we weren't matched. The thing is, I didn't care about that because I had this ideal and I was going to make it happen no matter what. Sadly, after 7 years, we split up because we finally had to acknowledge that we weren't getting on. At the same time, I was working with developing countries and with charities, and I'd also grown up in a lot of poor countries. And my heart was breaking in more ways than one. I no longer had faith that the world was a good place to be. I was close to 9/11 when that happened. I was very close to the London bombings when they happened 4 years later. At the same time, two people who were the closest to me said that they hated each other and never wanted to see each other again. My sister was in a near-fatal accident, and my heart just absolutely broke. I thought, I don't want to be in a world like this. I just thought there isn't any point. And it's a very dangerous place to be, because if you're depressed at the same time that you think that, you might well consider suicide. And I thought, I don't really want to be in this life, but I'll give it one more chance. I'd heard about a Zen monastery, which is in England. It's run by 25 English monks, both men and women, 50-50, and they run it in the Japanese Zen Buddhist tradition. All we did all day, apart from gardening and cooking, was hours and hours of meditation. And when you meditate, what you do is you turn down the volume of everything that's going on inside you, as well as everything that goes on outside. So you don't engage with media, you don't engage with your usual opinionating and your thoughts, your worries, your concerns. It's all happening. But you dive underneath that as if into an ocean. And when you dive into an ocean, for people who've tried that, everything outside becomes quiet and you go into a totally different world. So I did that. And when I did that, what I came across was absolute, abject terror. It was like there was a layer of emotion that was utter fear. Not for any particular reason, but it was like a primal fear that we're born with already. If you listen to a baby crying in terror, there's not necessarily any particular reason. It's just there. It's an instinct. And I realized that that's what I'd been channeling in my usual surface irritability that I'd been carrying around in my what I thought was my personality, was that fear that was coming up. But I had to persevere because there wasn't really any way out. There was suicide, or it was find out a way that I could live with, the way that the world was and the way that I was. So I kept going, and about 7 or 8 months into my meditation, I came across something utterly unexpected that I didn't even know existed.
And it was interesting, but maybe unsurprising, what Mia Hansen found once the noise had quieted down. This is from her TED Talk, played for you now on this The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. And it describes a woman who's been broken by a failed marriage, compounded by quite a few devastating external events. She has retreated to a monastery to save her life, basically, because she's been so depleted emotionally. And after going deep into the most frightening mental recesses, has discovered this.
The only way that I can describe it is love. It came to me in the most unexpected way. I was gardening with a nun, and she handed me a tiny little plant, about 5 millimeters, and it had 2 little leaves standing. It was light green. I remember it so well, and it was beaming. And I'm not even exaggerating about that. It looked like light was emanating from it. And this is only because I'd been turning down the volume on everything else that I noticed this tiny little thing. And it said, I am extremely precious. I am life itself. And it's your responsibility to take care of me. And normally, I hate gardening. I grew up in a city. I don't care about stuff like that. But I felt I had no choice but to honor it. So love exists in things. It exists in plants. It exists in nature. Not just in people and not just in romance. There's something that the Buddhists call Indra's net, which connects all of us and all things. And it means that everything that we do affects other people, even the tiniest little thing. Once I took care of an elderly friend at the monastery, and her feet were very painful, so I was putting band-aids on them. And I found myself in this sort of supplication posture. I was kneeling, of course. And I realized that that is what love is, taking care of other people's tiniest needs, if you can, if they need you, and always looking out for that. Also, there was another nun who said, "How are you?" And I'd never been asked, "How are you?" in exactly the way that she did. Because the difference was that she really meant it. And then she waited for my answer, and she really cared what my answer was. And she wasn't saying it just to get something from me, which I'd spent so many years in London that I wasn't used to somebody actually caring about such little things. So the nature of love with Indra's net, that network, is that it doesn't come from us. It comes through us. We can't control it necessarily. It comes through us, both emanating from us and something that we can receive. Receiving and giving is actually the exact same action. In helping my elderly friend, I was also receiving something.
So ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. The birds, they sang at the break of day. Start again, I seem to hear them say. Do not dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the wars, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be caught again. Bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free.
Leonard Cohen, his words of wisdom, the cracks are where the light gets in. None of our lives are perfect, there are always cracks. But cracks or no, should your spouse be your best friend? That's the topic on my Sharon Hour tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. Maybe your spouse should be your best friend, or maybe your best friend should be somebody else. Maybe it should be you. Maybe it should be the world at large, a more general love, rather than a concentrated, insular one. And as they say, in the universal, the specific So maybe that more general love leads you to more successful intimate relationships. So then, should your spouse be your best friend? It's a question we women ponder, because it's actually more common that wives are their husband's best friends than the other way around. Because as we all know, we women make friends more easily. So for us wives, what are the signs as to whether your husband or your potential husband can qualify as your best friend? According to this family share site, the number one would be when you tell each other everything. Though really, who actually tells everything? They're thinking maybe we'll tell them every event, but some thoughts we probably keep to ourselves and are better off keeping to ourselves. He's the only one you trust, maybe wrongly, but he is the one you trust. You each respond to teasing. You in fact love teasing each other. Not so sure I require that in a best friend. He's your defender. Yes, definitely would require that. Would actually require that of most of my friends. Well, not require it, but hope for it. He loves you for both the good and the bad days. Easier said than done, but one would hope that he wouldn't stop loving you because you were having a bad day. He loves you for your flaws. And you do him. Well, I'd say we aspire to love each other despite our flaws would be more accurate. You give each other good advice. Yes, hopefully. You would wish that of your best friend, that they give you advice without any personal agenda. With spouses, maybe it's hard to not let the personal agenda come into play. You listen to each other when you need to be heard. For sure, that's important. But there are so many quotidian problems and distractions that although it sounds like something you absolutely should do, it's maybe something that isn't done enough. He won't judge you for the little things. It's another requirement. But of course he will judge you for the little things and the big things. It's whether that judgment affects his love for you that is more relevant. You do everything together. Well, that's certainly a sign of best friendships. Maybe it doesn't have to be everything, but a lot of things. He knows you better than anyone else. Yep. So he should, if he's the only person that you've lived with 24/7 since you were a child. That's probably an accurate description, if not a necessity. He makes you happy. You couldn't have someone as a best friend that made you unhappy, could you? Actually, yes, you could, if he made you laugh enough. In between. Okay, here are a few more. He keeps you guessing. He does things for you in a cute, goofy sort of way. Don't know about that. He knows just what you need. That would be great. The worst days are when you're apart. Unless you've been together 24/7 for an awfully long time. Sometimes it's nice to have a miniature break. And then you appreciate each other all the more when you come back together. You love each other for your strange obsessions. No, would not agree with that. I think other people's strange obsessions are a little scary. And if you want to be reassured by your live-in partner, then if their strange obsessions aren't your strange obsessions, that would be a point of departure, not a point of togetherness. The best road trip you'll take is with your husband? Well, yes, hopefully that's true. And if so, that would qualify him as your best friend, because road trips are intense experiences. You're his whole world. Nothing matters more to him than you. You're the center of his universe and vice versa. Well, that's what this show is about. Should that happen in marriages or should it not? Is not being able to live without each other the same as being each other's best friends? I have to say my husband was my best friend for the 23 years we were married. Till in middle age he did the classic scarpering off with a younger model. So therein lies the danger if your spouse does become your best friend and they leave at some point, whether by volition or they die. I was lucky enough to inherit the friends we'd made during our marriage, if by default. But the dynamic is a little different when you're the single friend amongst married friends. And you don't get invited quite so much in your oneness as you did in your two-ness. So that may be a bit more true of single women than of single men. On the other hand, I made new friends, some besties amongst them, and had a little more quality time with friends that preceded the marriage. Still, for those living so tightly in each other's pockets, it can be a danger if the relationship ends for whatever reason. So I would suggest for the married people listening that they do make some effort to create good, intimate, extramural, not romantic, but platonic friends, so they have friends to turn to in case things go sour in the marital relationship or end by act of God. I would say marriage, a good marriage, is the ideal, but I'm also as comfortable in my own company as in others these days, so I guess I've learned some of the lessons that our speakers espoused during this show. Funny how spouse and espouse are the same word. And realized that before. The one thing it's hard to do alone, although I do it with television as my other half, is laugh. And I think a lot of people will say that laughter is the most valuable constituent of any relationship, but certainly a marital one that can otherwise be bogged down with strife. Here are a couple of talk show hosts talking about that. Transcribed for you here on my Sharon Now, me Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX935. First Megyn Kelly, then a group on The Today Show.
Should your spouse be your best friend? What do you think? Could be, yes, right? Well, I wanted someone else's opinion on this, so I've asked my good friend Craig Melvin to come. Okay, so what do you think of that? Should your spouse be your best friend, or should you have your best friend outside of your marriage?
In my marriage, she's my best friend. My wife, Lindsay, is my best friend. And it's probably because I don't have other friends.
You don't have the time to nurture.
But I think, and again, this is just my opinion, I think that you're doing it right. That should be the case, shouldn't it?
I believe you, yeah. And I agree with you, because Doug and I are best friends, too. It's not that I don't have other close friends. It's just no other relationship compares to that one.
Yes.
But the experts are saying that actually you will be happier if your spouse is your best friend. That it will make you a happier person, especially as you get older.
I can believe that.
That like you've got your buddy there,
yeah.
And you've got the shared sense of intimacy, and they're with you through thick and thin.
No one knows you like your spouse. We celebrate 6 years on Sunday. We haven't been married that long. But 6 years ago, I was a bit of a different person. And I think as you grow older, as you indicated, you know, you evolve and you change, and your spouse is evolving and changing with you.
Yeah,
and now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm kind of happy about
that. You're really
that.
Owning it. I know, yeah. I feel the same. Honestly, I would not have gotten through the past few years of my life without my husband, Doug, who is my best sounding board and everything, and the person whose opinion means the most to me. And I feel like it's a blessing because this is my second marriage. And after my first marriage, I didn't know whether I'd find somebody again. You know how whenever a relationship ends, you're like, I don't know, am I ever... And I feel really lucky that I married somebody who is my best friend and my best advisor. Now, you and Doug had a lovely exchange, and I don't think we could go so far as to call it a bromance.
No.
But those
not
are
yet.
Out there.
We might become bromances.
Those are out there, and they're in the news, and more guys are coming out and saying that their male friends are really important to them and allow them to show, like, their intimate side. Like, if you want to shed a tear.
Really?
Are you feeling that?
I don't think I've cried with my boys recently. We do a lot of things, but we don't typically
sit
around and
crier?
Cry. I have cried before. I mean, but when I get together with my buddies, we're typically not crying. You know, we're watching football.
But more
we're talking
and more,
about our wives, our best friends that we love so much.
More and more men are crying. They're saying men are crying more with their guy friends.
Really?
Yes.
Who's saying that?
I don't know.
Say one thing that is the key to a happy, long-lasting marriage. What would you guess? There's one thing to have in common.
Laughter. Lots of laughter.
Laughter. Communication.
Go with laughter.
Laughter is the correct answer. Hmm. Communication, also good. Also good, but according to dating guru James Priest, the one sign that can tell whether you and your partner are meant to be, do you have a sense of humor? He says, when you and your partner share the same sense of humor, yes, you see the funny side in most situations. You're more relaxed about what life throws your way. And this is a good one. You can defuse any argument easily. And quickly, I think that's true.
Yeah, I can see that. What?
Just mine was more she's laughing at me. I'm trying to make...
I think Annette makes me laugh more than anyone I've ever met.
That's
seriously?
Amazing.
Really?
No, sir, absolutely. She has a very wicked sense of humor.
And when someone makes you laugh, I mean, that's very romantic. You just like that
person
so much.
Things get heavy in marriage. They talk real serious stuff.
Yes.
And it helps to work through that by having a little levity.
Yeah.
And kind of going, hey, let's zoom out here for a second and try
and laugh about it.
And
yeah.
Laugh about it.
So, laughter. A lot of us can agree is key within a marriage. If your best friend is your spouse, Should Your Spouse Be Your Best Friend is the topic on my Sharon Hour tonight. That's me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. There's one thing that can cause discord in a marriage that's unlikely, except in extremes, to cause discord amongst best friends who aren't married, and that's money. Money always comes into play, doesn't it? Different attitudes towards money with your best friends. You can sort of take it or leave it, unless you're always the one paying, and they never are. But different attitudes towards money in a marriage can have dire results. And I was reading something in the Times Modern Love column, an article by one Abby Mims, who'd been asked by her fiancé to sign a prenup. And though it didn't really bother her in essence, the principle of it did a little bit. She could see why he would want it. They were both in their early 40s, and he was a saver and she was, well, not so much a spender, but she hadn't exactly saved. She was also the one that was more pushing for the marriage. Marriage somewhat scared him. But they had a child together who, at this point when marriage became a kind of inevitability for them, the child was a year and a half old. Ms. Mims said she had approximately $3,500 in savings, no retirement account, and a four-year-old Toyota Yaris with a Blue Book value of $8,000, on which she still owed $4,000. Her soon-to-be husband, if she signed the prenup, was a lot more solvent and had some considerable savings. Now, California law pretty much states what this prenup was stating, which was each of the couple would leave the marriage with what they had bought into it, and the rest would be divided, and that seemed perfectly fair to her. But he was worried because he said fights about money were what most often broke up relationships and marriages. And it was true even for them, even as soon as they started dating, because of the different ways they'd chosen to live their lives. She'd quit the corporate world to wait tables and write, and had been living paycheck to paycheck ever since. And as a result, she'd racked up $10,000 in credit card debt when she first met her fiancé and had no savings. Her fiancé had been working for about 15 years at the same company, in finance, and she had no idea how much he'd amassed, but it was probably considerable. Now, he had actually at one point told her that if he could have done anything with his life, he would have been a rock journalist. He wasn't totally unhappy with his career, but it suggested to her that he'd traded passion for stability, whereas she'd done the opposite. So she felt it was kind of legitimate for him to ask for a prenup, but it still bothered her. And it bothered her lawyer. He said that a house sale clause could be unfair to her. And the money thing had actually been a fixation of her fiancé and annoyed her to some degree. He was questioning her happy hour outings with her girlfriends and wondering aloud whether she was ever going to find a job with benefits and a 401k. And it made her feel controlled sometimes, even trapped. Her mother said, "He's got to let you breathe or he's going to lose you." And it became enough of an issue that they spent a few months in couples therapy when their son was an infant. And those sessions did help her understand that his money issues stemmed from family dynamics and a string of former girlfriends who'd betrayed him. But understanding the situation didn't necessarily make either of them feel different about it. He still wanted the prenup. She was still uncomfortable with it, a little humiliated by it. And at one point she confessed to her fiancé that it made her feel sort of worthless. "What a mess," he said. "I thought it would be simple. I forget that nothing's simple when you get lawyers involved. Listen, can we just sign it and be done with it?" And after a little bit of negotiating between her lawyer and his, he had paid for the lawyers, by the way, they changed the house sale clause to be more in her favour, and she went ahead and signed. It was 2 days before the wedding, and they went to a diner and sat there in silence. "I'm so sorry," said her fiancé. "This was an awful thing I did to you and to us. And for all the fights we've had about money, this was a huge waste of it." "Well, there was no other way," said the writer of this article, Abby Mims. "If I'd fought you on it, everything would have imploded." "I know," he said. She appreciated his apology and also that ultimately they'd both be better off from what they'd done, even if they didn't yet realize it. Her fiancé had a signed agreement that made him feel safer, and she didn't have to fight to acknowledge how unnecessary it was in the first place. And what's more, money was less of an issue as a result of the prenup. She says, right now I don't even know where it is, but our fights about money had eased. It was almost as if that document became a repository for our anxieties, so that we didn't have to hold on to them. So maybe being best friends in a marriage is a little different from being best friends outside of it, because a few more compromises are necessary to keep marital best friendships in play. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about should spouses be best friends, or is that either an unnecessary or even a less desirable component of marriage than the term would suggest? Should we hope to, expect to, or even can we get everything in one package with desire, sexual desire, unflagging sexual desire thrown in? It's not always realistic.
But I can dream, can't I? I'm aware my heart is a sad affair. There's much disillusion there, but I can dream, can I?
Should your husband be your best friend was the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX935. It's something to consider whether you have a spouse or are looking for one. But there's no more time to go into it any further tonight. We've reached the end of this Sharon Hour. If you want to hear it again, you can go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. Or you can listen on iTunes. But do check out our website. We've got a wonderful concert coming up, and there are always fabulous things to see there and other shows to listen to, music shows and talk shows. In the meantime, this is Sharon James, wishing you a wonderful week ahead, hoping you will come back again for more topics of discussion, interviews, and conversations on KX935's The Sharon Hour every Sunday night at 6:00.